The View Screen is your weekly Star Trek magazine program, streaming live on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got lots of news, features, and lots of love for our chosen Star Trek family all across the globe. So this week is our bonus episode of season one, and we're in collaboration with Strange New Pod for the last days of Disco Festival.
Now, if you're not able to tune in live, don't worry, we've got you covered. We have this as an audio on a podcast. So go ahead, search for the View Screen on any podcast platform, and you'll find us there.
We really appreciate all of your support. So we would like to remind you of the 287th rule of acquisition: subscribers equals profit. So please remember to hit that like and subscribe button. Make sure you never miss an episode. We do have a goal of getting to 100 subscribers by the end of this episode, would you believe? So right now, we've got around 80. So if you're on episode and you're watching us, please do subscribe. Let's hit that milestone goal together.
So, Kelvin, my dear, we are bonus episode 11. How are you doing this week?
That we are the show that just won't go away. This is our encore episode, if you will. Although I'm not sure I should be speaking French, given all of the French bashing that has been going on over Prodigy this weekend.
What happened? I mean, literally, what happened? Did they think that they had permission? Did someone literally leak it? This heads are going to roll.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tomorrow they will. Nobody works over the weekend in Europe. Right. Well, as you may guess by Amy's t-shirt, my uniform, we would like to dedicate this show to Star Trek Discovery. And we do have a special lineup coming to you featuring hosts from all across the BQN podcast network. So what have we got then today? We have a cooking demonstration with Matthew Dempsey from The Food Replicator. Hey, Matt.
Hi.
Because there's been so many captains of Discovery, we're bringing in Captain Jeremiah of Captain's Couch.
Hey. And because Discovery is so well produced and cinematic, we've got Matt Jennings from Cinema Z joining us today. Hey, Matt. Well, another packed show for our swan song. So let's get to it.
All right.
Hey, Matt. Right, we may have noticed Amy's just jumped off stage, so I wonder where she may be going. Any ideas? Hey!
All right, so this week we are cooking out of, as I just closed the page to what I needed to be on, the Star Trek cookbook, the newest one that was published just a couple of years ago. Where's the page I need? Here we go. So to be honest, there aren't a lot of Discovery recipes in the book. Because it was published, you know, I think what's the copyright date here? 2022, 21, something like that. And of course, books are written in advance. So there hadn't been that many seasons of Discovery when the author was testing, but we're doing crotaleg skewers for this particular episode. I've got a brief little slideshow to talk about crotaleg. If we could get that up on screen. And crotalegs, we go to the next slide. We're first mentioned in DS9. We can see Kira and Odo talking about it. Then there was a fun Easter egg in Lower Decks, Mr. Crotta Leg, the stand there. And then you can flip to the next slide for me. And I love this so much. So this comes from 2017, the first season of Disco, where Mary Chifo's character, Laurel, is eating a chicken drumstick, as the one person tweeting says. And she writes back, no, it's a Crotta Leg. So there we go. That's how it ties into Star Trek Discovery. So these are essentially going to be meatballs that have a sauce component and, of course, the meatball component. I've already made the sauce ahead of time because this is live TV, but I will talk about what goes into it. So the sauce will have some garlic cloves, which these are pre-peeled because I'm lazy. Then it's going to have a little bit of soy sauce, molasses, tahini, which is a sesame seed paste. Very good stuff.
I love tahini.
Rice vinegar. A little bit of vegetable oil. You could use avocado oil, really any oil. This is just what I had on hand. A little bit of sriracha for some heat. One of my favorite spices, smoked paprika. Very good. And then just salt and pepper. And you basically blitz it in a blender, and it makes the sauce. Sauces are not very exciting to look at in a container, but that's already done. So what I'm doing in the first segment here, then, is making the meat mixture itself. So I got to grab the turkey, because I did not have that ready to go. Thank you. Oh, I got my sous chef, Amy, here. And this is going to come together really quickly. Just a few things go in here, but there are some good techniques that you're going to want to know. So firstly, you're going to grab yourself a bowl, and you're going to dump the turkey in the bowl. And then your sous chef will throw away the package. Then, the interesting part of this recipe, I think. So we're going to use a food processor. I have a mini one here. If you have just a regular blender or like a Ninja or something, that will work. We are going to throw an egg into the food processor. No raw eggs this time, Kelvin, so you don't have to worry about our safety.
Oh, I was waiting for you to wash your hands after handling the raw chicken, but never mind.
It's all going in the same thing. Don't worry about it. I'll be touching it and massaging my meat here in just a moment, so stay tuned, viewers.
Can't wait
and
for that.
The really interesting ingredient is anchovies. So on my show, The Food Replicator, I normally try recipes as printed. I don't change a thing. But I recipe tested this last night to make sure I knew what I was doing. And it called for 2 ounces of anchovies. And I like anchovies. Anchovies are in a lot of dishes. Caesar salad dressing, for example, classically has anchovies, but you can't taste it. You could taste it in this. And it calls for 2 ounces. Last night, I only did 1. I'm going to cut it back even more. It was a little bit fishy. So if you can eyeball it, great. I'm going to do about 1/2 ounce. But if you don't, I think a kitchen scale is one of the best tools you can have in the kitchen. I'm just going to measure it out because I don't want it to be too much. And actually, I don't have that much left in the jar based on my recipe testing. This is just anchovies in olive oil. I only have 0.4 ounces, honestly.
Do they dissolve into it or are they still quite solid?
Yes. So what's going to happen is the egg is in here. We're going to dump the anchovies in and we're going to blitz it.
Ah.
So apologies in advance, viewers. This is going to be a little loud, but we're just going to blitz it up. So essentially what I'm looking for here is that the anchovy has essentially disintegrated. There's still a few chunks. I'm going to blitz it a few more times. That's good enough for live TV.
Yeah.
So we're going to take that. This is why I didn't care about washing my hands, because we're just going to dump it right in. This is right on top of the turkey. So that is good to go. Then I'm still not going to wash my hands because I got to massage the meat. We're going to add a little bit of salt, just half a teaspoon here. I always use kosher salt. It's larger grain, so things won't be as salty. We're going to do...
I'm so glad you just explained what kosher salt is, Matt, because we don't call it that in the UK, so we would call
really,
it
sea salt.
No, we would call it maybe rock salt or sea salt.
Oh, interesting. I don't know. Here in the US, sea salt is different from kosher salt, because kosher salt is not from the sea. I'm not exactly sure why it's called kosher. I'm not sure if it has something to do with it being made kosher by like a rabbi or something. But the reason cooks in the U.S. tend to prefer it is I can't really demonstrate, the granules are pretty big, whereas table salt, they're very small. So yeah. 1/2 teaspoon of table salt will be way saltier than 1/2 teaspoon of kosher.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it just makes things less salty. 1 teaspoon of that sauce that I pre-made with all those ingredients we talked about, just stirring to reincorporate. We got that. And then most meatball recipes, whether it's a beef meatball, a lamb meatball, in this case turkey, is going to use panko breadcrumbs. This helps it bind together, keeps it a little bit lighter, because if it was just meat, it'd be super dense. Don't want that.
And I prefer panko over breadcrumbs.
Right. Has to be panko. Almost for the same reason as kosher versus table salt.
Yeah.
Here in the States, if you buy breadcrumbs, it's basically sandpaper, or not sand. What's it called?
Like sand.
Sawdust.
Like sand. Yeah.
Yeah. But panko, again, you probably can't really see, but it's can you see that? Probably not. It's pretty big compared to like dust. Dust is the word I was looking for. Yeah. And then meatballs always mix with your hands. The key, though, is not to overmix. I want to get it incorporated, get those breadcrumbs throughout. But if you overmix, you're going to have dense, gluey, gummy meatballs. Nobody wants that. So I'm just going to do this for a couple of seconds. And then I'm going to look to, so you won't probably be able to see it on the screen, but I can sort of see a little bit of the anchovy mixture because it's got the brown color. But I'm going to just make sure I don't see any streaks of brown to make sure the anchovy is well incorporated, that the breadcrumbs are evenly distributed, and that's it. I don't want to mix it more than that because they're going to get gummy. Then it sits in the fridge for 30 minutes to sort of firm up so I can shape into meatballs, and that's it for the first part.
Wonderful. Thank you, Matthew. I do feel like Amy should have been cleaning up or something around you there. Come on, Amy. Pull your weight.
She's a great sous chef, although I know we're not supposed to be speaking French, but she's a great sous chef, so there we go. So we'll let this firm up for 30 minutes. We'll come back and I'll actually form them into balls.
Wonderful. That's great. Amy, get yourself back to the studio and we shall carry on. Thank you, Matt. We look forward to seeing how that turns out a little bit later. Right. Okay. So why Amy makes the mad dash across her house, it's several acres wide. Let's welcome Captain Jeremiah from the Captain's Couch to the view screen. Welcome to the view screen, my friend.
Yes. Thank you, Kelvin. Thank you, Amy. It's good to see you again. It feels like we were just in the same room and now we've been separated by time and distance once more.
Yeah. Absolutely. But we shall be together again very, very soon, I'm sure. How are things with you? Soon. How's everything going?
That's a loaded question, my friend. Let's just say I have entered my season 5 Janeway opener phase where I am locked in my quarters, blaming myself for every decision that has ever been made in my life and torturing myself over all of those decisions.
Oh dear. Well, the stars will shine again very soon as you get out of the void, that whatever which one you're in, my friend.
Let's hope we find that way out.
So tell us about your show, Captain's Couch.
Well, the Captain's Couch is a Star Trek Voyager podcast. Initially, it was going to go through each episode in chronological order. However, on this seems indefinite hiatus, I have decided to reformat a little bit. And when I eventually return, it will be more of a broader discussion of Voyager subjects rather than an episode recap. So I'm looking at, we will be talking about races, specifically Vidians, Kazon, Hirogen, Voyager technology themes, Voyager morality themes, subjects along those lines to make it a little diverse in this wild landscape of podcasts where there are so many episode rewatch shows.
Interesting. Can't wait for that. So, I hope you're not scrapping season 2 that you've got in the can because that's the episode I'm on.
No, your episode still will be featured. It will be a little bit of the 3 episodes that were recorded prior to my mental breakdown. They'll still be aired. They'll just seem a little temporarily displaced with some of the things that we talked about and some of the topics that were going on in that time. But no, they'll definitely be salvaged.
Well, I wonder how well they age. But in the meantime, why don't you, let's get on with what you're here to show us today. What are we looking
at? Well, we are here to discuss the many captains of the USS Discovery. And I did the math the other day, and it seems like in Discovery's not even 5 seasons, we have had more captains of this starship than we have seen in any previous iteration of Trek.
Yeah.
It's a revolving door of captains, which honestly has made the show quite interesting from my perspective.
Yeah. I agree.
Sometimes two at once.
Yeah. Yes. So let's bring those captains up. So our very first captain, of course, is Gabriel Lorca, who we found out very quickly was not such a great guy, as he was the mirror version of Lorca that had crossed over into the Prime Universe masquerading with his ultimate goal of using the Discovery to overthrow the Terran Emperor Georgiou. I have never quite decided if I would like to know about Prime Lorca or not, or to find out his true fate. I think it's quite interesting to leave the character as we know him.
Don't you think it's interesting, though, that when season one finished and there was all the hashtags of find Prime Lorca and everyone was up in arms, as soon as our, what I imagine, next slide is, everybody just got over it and was obsessing over Anson Mount. We're fickle.
We are fickle. Let's see that next slide, because I'll tell you the truth, I can't remember who's next up. Oh, that's right.
Ooh.
It is Mr. Saru. Because we know that Saru obviously was Lorca's first officer, and once Lorca disappeared, or was killed actually, that Saru took command of the starship. And Saru, honestly, is one of my absolute favorite characters of Discovery. He is going to be the one I miss the most, not only because Doug himself is a terrific human being, but Saru is just such a fascinating character. A race we've never seen before. We're learning everything about the Kelpians through his eyes. We're also seeing two completely different versions of Starfleet through his eyes, as well as rediscovering Vulcan in their current time setting through a completely alien character, which is something I've been wanting from Trek for a long time, of let's move away from Starfleet and the Federation. Let's see this vast universe from another culture's perspective. Let's have Star Trek Kronos. Let's have Star Trek Cardassia. Let's see the inner political workings of these races and view the Federation and Starfleet from their eyes, and not see the Federation as we've always seen it. Let's see it from the other side of the quadrant.
Right.
Was the Delta Quadrant not far enough away for you?
Oh, no, no. The Delta Quadrant, you know, it's my happy place. Let's not mess with it yet.
You know, one thing I really liked about Captain Saru was, you know, he was preparing and trying to be his best. And so he self-analyzes and self-reflects, you know, especially when he's like, well, what makes good captains? And, you know, we have that famous scene where they pull up and there's Jonathan Archer. And, you know, so he's looking at what qualities make a good leader. And I think self-reflection is just so important in any role, responsibility, leadership role like that. So I really like that with Saru.
I love that too. And I, especially because I can relate to his self-doubt and him wanting to abdicate those responsibilities, but also wanting to keep the center chair. It's very much a conflict I am very familiar with. Let's see who we have up next. So I put these a little out of order when I was reordering this morning because I wasn't awake. If we do in chronological order, Killy, as she is known, would actually come between Lorca and Saru. As once Discovery crossed into the Mirror Universe, we find out that there, Tilly is actually a insane homicidal dominatrix who is the captain of Discovery. Not only do I love Tilly, again, one of my top favorite characters, I'll just get it out there. It's Tilly, Saru, and Burnham are my favorite Discovery characters. And I loved seeing her in the center chair. It's especially as this version of herself, very much reminiscent of Intendant Kira and Evil Janeway, and or Living Witness Janeway, I should say. And I thought that Mary was absolutely brilliant in this role. And it was very, very interesting to see this take on the character, probably the most evil counterpart in the Mirror Universe that we have ever seen before. I mean, Tilly was evil.
I enjoyed the authentic Captain Killy that you got in Terra Firma later on in the series, because at the beginning it was our Tilly pretending
masquerading
to be, and it was the comedy aspect of pretending to be a badass and being really nervous about it. So I love that.
Yes, I did too. And she's wild. I both fear her and love her, which I think is absolutely
a dangerous combination.
Right. But I think from a production standpoint, that was the entire goal for that character, is to both love and fear her, which I think in that universe, you would need in that position, you need to be both loved and feared.
Yeah.
So let's see who we have up next in the center seat. Here we have Real Tilly. Again, I was not awake when I put these in order this morning, so I don't know how I messed that up. But we also see the real Sylvia Tilly in command of Discovery once during the culmination of the burn against Osiris' ship. And Tilly, you know, we've known through the entire series that she wanted the command track, that was the goal that she wanted. Those circumstances have led to her questioning that decision, as we know it didn't go that well for her. But as Picard said, you can commit no mistakes and still fail. And that's exactly what happened to her. She did nothing wrong and still failed. But at the end of the day, her command decisions helped lead to the success and rescue of Discovery's mission. She was able to save the ship, help save the crew. It didn't turn out the way that she wanted it, but I think it was a good experience for her for a future command of her own.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't see it as a failure. I find it interesting that someone who was so driven on a particular course to get somewhere and was such a high achiever that she got there so quickly to then decide, well, maybe that's not for me, I think is a story that we've not seen in Star Trek before. You've just had the, you know, the Rikers, the Kirks, I want to be captain by 30. And to see someone who actually achieves and then questions themselves and has to pivot, I thought that was really fascinating with Tilly.
I do too. I think the only other instance we would have seen something like that would be Harry Kim in the episode with the sentient warhead, where he was in command of the night shift. They ran across that warhead. He made the decision to bring it aboard Voyager, and it didn't go well for him. Not to shoot torpedoes at Harry, but that was really the only instance where we saw him actually working for that and not just being sad that he wasn't given a promotion just because he wanted a promotion. I think Tilly actually earned her opportunities, and we saw that play out in her arc where we haven't seen that in others.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Up next for command, we have Philippa Georgiou.
Prime.
We have Mirror Georgiou masquerading as Prime Georgiou. Because at this time, Georgiou was never the captain of Discovery. She was, you know, long digested by those Klingons. By the time Mirror Georgiou takes command of Prime Discovery, you know, I would have watched a Star Trek show just based off of the first episode of Discovery on the Shenzhou with Georgiou in command. I liked Michelle Yeoh quite a bit. I liked the character of Georgiou. I love the Emperor of her. So to see her in this capacity where once again she's kind of the center character for that episode, and she's in a way playing both versions of herself, is fascinating. I love an actor that can go back and forth between the two. You know, Kira did it very well when she played both regular Kira and Intendant Kira. I think Georgiou was a great legacy to add to that kind of duality of characters. Also just fascinating presence on the bridge, and would love to see more of it. Thoughts?
I love, Michelle Yeoh. And I'm in my rewatch and just seeing her on every time she's on screen, it's like you gravitate towards her. And I really liked seeing her, the mirror, pretending to be Prime. I thought that was so good and so well played. I just loved it. And you're right. I am so looking forward to Section 31, you know, movie with her.
Yeah.
You know, in a perfect universe, we could have all things that we would want. And one of the things I would love to see is the great women leaders of Star Trek together, which would be just a total temporal paradox, right? To have them all have number one, have Janeway, Kira, Georgiou, Burnham, have them all together. But just imagine what that would be like to have that group of individuals together to crack a problem and fix something.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be too many cooks in the kitchen, or would it be a powerhouse of solutions?
I'm going to go for the latter.
Yeah.
I do think that Georgiou created a little bit of a problem for Star Trek in itself, though, of the morality of Star Trek. To have an evil character becoming such a fan favorite that with no kind of comeuppance of being a mass murderer, hating the ideals of the Federation, and to now actually having been the star of her own movie, you know, it is a very strange concept to have the baddie as the central character. So,
you know, I agree with you, but at the same time, the non-Trek portion of my soul has always rooted for the bad guys to win. So actually getting to see the bad guy win for once and get away with everything is quite satisfying to me. Because in every piece of media that I've ever seen, I tend to always want, like, let's see the bad guy win. I want to see what happens when the bad person wins.
But isn't it a true Trek philosophy of having her improve and be better than she was? And really, at the end, before she's going into the Guardian, like, Burnham believes that she can be better, that she's not going to get into trouble. You know, and she's like, are you going to be checking up on me? And she's like, you shouldn't be doing anything that I need to check up on you, right? Putting it back on this, you know, yourself. So I really like that philosophy being applied to her.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Amy. I mean, the character did change by the time she walked through the Guardian. And we saw that as she was returned to her original universe and discovered that she no longer fit in there. That why she still shared a lot of those traits, she was no longer the Emperor. She no longer had it within herself to rule that empire in the manner that she had in the past. And had she stayed, it would have been her undoing because she would have been eaten alive, literally.
I mean, to change what this mirror universe, like, you are bad. No, you can change yourself to be better. Like, what better Trek ideal than that? Like, I love it.
Very much so. Well, who has the con next, Kelvin?
Oh, here she is.
Admiral Cornwell. My favorite. My favorite admiral that was not Janeway. Let's face it, nobody will ever take that spot. But Admiral Cornwell, what an amazing character portrayed by an amazing actress. I love Jane Brooke, and I love this admiral. I thought she was cut from the same cloth as the great ladies of Trek, very much of the same caliber. I love the fact that she had a background other than command, but had been elevated to this position of an admiral in Starfleet. The fact that we have an admiral that wasn't a badmiral was also amazing for a change, because let's face it, most of the admirals are badmirals. Even Admiral Ross from Discovery, if you read any of the books, the pre-Picard books, he turns out to be a badmiral. So it was just nice to have a good admiral from the get-go that actually was there to do the right thing and not for her own agenda, and sadly ended up sacrificing herself in the end, which, great episode, but why did we have to kill her? Come on.
I'm still holding with the theory that Laurel beams her aboard her ship just as the explosion happens, and she's going to pop up in Strange New Worlds season 3 at some point.
That would be amazing.
Yes, we need that to happen.
Putting it out there.
I loved the way, like, I thought it was amazing when she took command of Discovery. One of the things we've never seen before is that there's this secret override protocol that an admiral can just beam aboard a ship and completely shut it down and rescind all command authorization or any access to any system from the entire crew. Like, where has that been hiding the last 60 years in Star Trek? That was fascinating.
Thank God that wasn't the case in TNG. Think of all them admirals that came on the Enterprise and Picard had to remind them that it was his ship, not the fleet. If Captain Admiral Pressman had one of those, it would have been a different episode.
You know, maybe the removal of control also negated that command ability within a starship. Maybe that was some functionality of the control system. I don't know. We can speculate all day long. But unfortunately, we didn't get to know Katrina very well or for very long, but her presence was a memorable one. But let's move on to our next commanding officer of Discovery. And now we have everybody's favorite, Captain Christopher Pike by the incredible Anson Mount. What a surprise twist this was. Who would have ever thought that we would have seen Pike show up of all characters in Discovery, and it would lead to an entirely new season because we demanded it.
Mm-hmm. It really does show the power of the fandom and the fact that we commanded this to happen. It's just unbelievable. And we're trying to do it again with Star Trek Legacy.
We've succeeded several times with fan demands over the last six decades. Mm. You know, we demanded, we didn't exist in the beginning, but we as a collective saved the show from its second season. Mm-hmm. Our voices were collectively heard and we got Strange New Worlds. Our voices were heard again and we saved Prodigy, at least in order to get a second season out of it. Mm-hmm. And of course, now we are screaming at the bit to have Legacy. And while our demands have not yet been met, our voices are not quiet. So community, mm-hmm. let's hit this again and succeed. Yeah. You know, we have a good history of getting what we want out of the powers that be from Star Trek, but we need to be persistent and let them know resistance is futile.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, back to Captain Pike, and or as a couple of my friends like to refer to him, Daddy Pike. What a great addition to Discovery. What a way to really turn the tables on the show and reinvent it in the second season, which I don't think hurt anything that was established at all. I think it just enhanced it and made it that much more interesting, adding Pike and adding Spock and sprinkling in a little number one there. I think Anson brings a great deal to that original character that was never even supposed to be seen by us in that unaired pilot, but yet was released in the 80s when they finally restored it and released it, Roddenberry did. When we got to see the cage for the first time and Pike was solidified in canon.
Outside of the menagerie kind of clips.
Yes.
It's a standalone in its own right. Yeah.
So yeah, what a great way to build off of actually Star Trek's original character and original captain.
Exactly.
And get to know him. And I think Anson has brought a tremendous amount to that character and made him his own. And I kind of forget about Jeffrey Hunter and what Bruce Greenwood in the reboots. It's like, yeah, Anson is Pike. This is the Pike that we deserve, and this is the Pike that we need. And he piloted Discovery through one of its most treacherous sagas. I lost my train of thought. I'm very sorry, because I know this is live.
Don't worry about it.
And with Pike, you know, comes, he brought a great deal of change to Discovery's crew and the way that it worked and some of the dynamic there between Burnham and Saru, which ultimately I think he helped make them stronger within their own relationships with one another. And let's see who took the helm after Mr. Pike did.
Here she is.
Saru was in there in between, because we know once they crossed into the Red Angel wormhole, Saru had command of Discovery. He fired Burnham as his number one. Once they got back together, she's had a very rough trek to this center seat here. And again, Sylvia took command in between that. And then eventually ended up where the character was supposed to be from the get-go. As we know, or most of us know now, the entire premise of Discovery was always the journey to the chair for Burnham. It was the show, she was the central character, not as the captain. And we were, the purpose of it was to see her journey through her career to getting to that center seat. Finally, she had it, she lost it, she had it again. Very fascinating to see a lead character fail and succeed and fail and succeed, but ultimately to get where they know that they belong. And hopefully, collectively, we know that she belongs there as well. And we here we are going into season five, and I hope that we see her retain the center seat through the very end, in that she is not displaced somewhere in the middle. I hope that they don't do that to us. But I think that she absolutely deserves the chair. And it's great to see another strong female character in command of a Star Trek show. Because we've only had it once, and she had some very, very big shoes to fill. But I think that she's doing a very great job of it.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, let's bring in the rest of the panel as well and just reflect on that incredibly long list, longer than I thought it would be, list of captains. Well done, Jeremiah. You really, really
Thank you.
Managed to be a so, so comprehensive with that. Matthew, starting with you, any thoughts on the lineup there? Any outstanding moments you want to comment on?
My great overview. I loved all the pictures you selected, but I do want to promise the viewers that there is no Captain Georgiou in my Klingon Krata leg meatballs. It's Georgiou free. I was thinking, I think Tilly to some degree mirrors Wesley's journey in TNG, where he decides that Starfleet's not for him. So he's different in that he leaves Starfleet, but he does decide, hey, my dad's path is, and my mom's path and Picard's path is not my own. But she does it in a slightly different way. So I thought that was such a good point that I've never quite thought of. And I think it is interesting and still unique for Star Trek. It's still just add in Wesley, And so that's such a cool way to think of her character, I think, that's never occurred to me.
Interesting. And what about yourself, Matt?
Something that I've thought about as I've gone back, because I've been trying to go back here and there and watch a little bit of Discovery before we get into season five. And, it is very interesting. We know it, the journey, we get to see the journey from her being, second in command of the Shenzhou to becoming the captain of Discovery. And that how of all of that is very interesting to watch. It's also very interesting to me when I think about it, and I think about Captain Kirk and the Kirk-isms, the jumping into action, the shoot first and take questions later. There is a little bit, maybe a lot of bit of that in Michael Burnham that I've kind of enjoyed watching. And I mean, as at least the first season of Discovery takes place 10 years before Captain Kirk, I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking about this evolution. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's more so now that there is more of Burnham in Kirk.
Right.
And, on that point, Matt, Janeway makes a comment at one point that captains of that era were cut from a different cloth. They were much quicker to draw their phasers first. Exactly. And in her time, they would all be cashiered out of Starfleet like that. But this was very, this time is very much the Wild West of the Alpha Quadrant.
Absolutely. Yeah, and put that together with Captain Archer that was just way out there, we get that, the cowboy and like that transition. We're getting this captain arc of Starfleet because, by the time we get Picard and Janeway, like that is a different breed. Oh my gosh, what a great, like Burnham fills in between Archer and Kirk. Wow. Mm-hmm.
There's very much a lineage and a process to each captain. And it is, it's so interesting to watch. And again, it's very interesting to think that, technically, chronologically, Burnham came first. So Burnham's, there's more Burnham in Kirk. And I love that. And, as we've watched her grow into this captaincy, or as we've seen her, you know, become captain at the end of season three and then in season four, we see her kind of understand why she has the captain's chair and what she, you know, and the what's of what it means to be a captain throughout the fourth season, which I really enjoyed watching as well. I think that Michael Burnham is a good balance between the shoot first, ask questions later, and the diplomacy. She can do both and follow both to the extreme whenever necessary. And it's been a pleasure to watch that journey. I'm very excited to see what happens in season five. And I hope that I think we will get more discovery after season five. I have a feeling. I just have a feeling we're going to see more of this crew.
I'm hoping and I hate to be one of those people, but I'm overly not excited about Academy because I like my Star Trek out in space. I like trekking. That's the point of Star Trek, right?
And
I feel like being landlocked at the Academy. I don't know. I'm hopeful, but I'm also, I have reservations. But one of the things that keeps me hopeful of, okay, this is going to be in the same timeline of Discovery. And it's except for, you know, the TNG Voyager era, we've not had shows set in the same point in time together running
right,
currently.
Right.
So with Discovery ending and Academy being in the same time, I'm hoping that's going to open the door for a lot of crossover between Discovery characters. You know, maybe Burnham's going to show up and with Discovery and take the cadets on a training mission, you know, something like that, that we can keep a rotation of these Discovery characters in. I'm really, really, especially because I think we already all know that Tilly is crossing over to the Academy show.
Right.
So I think that's going to be the bridge between the two series.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what's interesting as well is that, you know, we've had in regards to television shows, Star Trek television shows that have been more stationary in their setting. I mean, Deep Space Nine was also very much like that as well. And, I didn't have my reservations about it because I don't know how old I was when DS9 came out. But, you know, I know that there was concern about DS9 just taking place on a station and not being mobile and not moving. But, you know, I think, you know, I'm very curious to see what happens with Academy and with where they're going to be able to go in regards to, in regards to character journeys, but, you know, what shenanigans will they get into where they'll have to leave Earth? They'll have to go on a training mission on Discovery or some other starship. So,
And Matt, you just laid it on a great point. Is the Academy going to take place on Earth, or is it going to take place? Is the Academy integrated into that Federation headquarter bubble thing?
Right.
You know, that's a good point of view. Just because Earth has rejoined the Federation, is Starfleet going to relocate back to Earth? That's very fascinating. Something I hadn't considered.
Yeah. One of the things I love about Discovery and the captaincy or the journey is I love sequence, order, collections. And when you used to see things in the Berman era, you'd always see Kirk, Picard, Sisko, Janeway. And then when Discovery came back, they never knew whose face to put on the lineup. Was it the captain? Well, we can't put Burnham because she's not the captain. So we'll put Lorca. Oh, the new captains, you've got Giorgio, you've got Law. Oh, and it just really threw everything up into the mix. Whereas now we've had that journey that you can just put Burnham there to take her place in that long list. But the journey, what you said earlier, Matt, I think it's great. Everyone, if you remember when Voyager finished, Voyager got home and everyone said it would have been lovely to have a season eight to see what happened when they were at home. Whereas the journey to the chair, she's at the chair and we actually get to enjoy seeing her as a captain rather than just the final episode of Discovery is you're now Captain Burnham. So that's one of the things I love. And I'm doing a little bit of a rewatch as well, like others are, getting ready for season five and seeing Sonequa in command. It is sort of lovely the way they've brought her personality to it, a lot like Janeway did in the later seasons. Sonequa's doing that straight away from being captain because we've seen that journey of her getting there, and I love it.
You know, Kelvin, I not all of us wanted that season 8 of Voyager, because as Voyager's biggest fan, I never wanted them to get home. I never wanted that. I'm still angry that Voyager was ended, where Voyager still could be on the air today as a generational Star Trek show. Mm-hmm. As the actors aged out and wanted to move on to other things, those characters could have retired or died, and we could have seen their descendants, Voyager, being a true generational ship. And Voyager could still be out there in the Delta Quadrant. There's no reason Voyager should have ever ended. I'm going to die on that hill. I am still very angry that my show ended.
Oh, but then we wouldn't get Prodigy.
I know that, and I love Prodigy, but, you know, I want what I want, and my soul wanted Voyager to remain in the Delta Quadrant. Because it was about the journey. It was about the family and not the destination.
Right.
It's what it was always about.
Just well, listen, we have some comments in the chat asking what is their favorite captains. And we have, hi, William Jackson. Howdy, Trekkies. Favorite disco captain is Burnham, hands down. However, I loathe that we may never see Prime Universe Good Giorgio or Prime Lorca. It's a shame.
Yeah.
And
well, Giorgio, we did see, but and she got eaten by Klingons. So we did get to see her.
And we have Rashid. Hi, guys. My favorite captain, Burnham, but I absolutely loved Captain Giorgio. Wish we saw more of her, definitely.
I love that we're getting so much love for Captain Burnham quite often, yes. Especially in, you know, in the Twitter space, as Trekkie Twitter people are sometimes a little bit mean about, you know, Burnham. Well, I'm loving the love.
To get on my soapbox here one more time, anybody that hates Discovery, hates on Discovery or Burnham, all I have to say is that you should be thankful for Discovery and everything that Discovery has done for the franchise, because without Discovery, we would have gotten nothing else of the second golden era of Star Trek. Yeah. We owe all of it to Discovery. Yeah. Like, love it or hate it, we owe everything to Discovery.
Exactly.
And it was obviously in the modern era. And it was obviously a success, or we would have gotten nothing that came after.
Yeah.
Well said. Amy, where can we see more of a discussion on the Captains of Discovery?
Listen, Strange New Pod, go over to their YouTube. They have a very in-depth, I mean, we're just a little, you know, talk show segment here. In-depth discussion of those captains over on the Strange New Pod YouTube channel. So go check them out. Great.
Wonderful. Jeremiah, thank you so much for coming on the view screen with that really comprehensive presentation. We will see you guys a little later in the show.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Wow, we've got through so much already, Amy, and we've still got to get back to the kitchen yet. So let's take a little break.
What else can you listen to on the BQN? Replicate yourself a mug of hot chocolate and join Amy, Mark, Christos, and Kelvin as they discuss everything and anything in the Star Trek universe on All Good Things. Boost yourself with an energy drink and join Davey on YouTube and Twitch for reviews and live streams of classic, cheap, and sometimes more recent video games on Bargain Bin Gamer. Brew yourself a pot of coffee and join Jeremiah to discuss Star Trek Voyager on The Captain's Couch. Mix your favorite cocktail and join Mark and Matt at Cinema Z to discuss the films you probably missed but should definitely check out. Pour a cup of tea, Earl Grey, hot, and listen to Steven and Keith as they discuss the next generation of Trek on Galaxy Class. Get yourself something caffeinated and learn an interesting bit of history with Chrissy and Jason on History with the Zalogis. Have a bowl of Plomeek soup and join Thad and Chrissy and a guest to discuss new episodes of Star Trek as they are released on Infinite Diversity. Have something to sharpen your mind and put your Trek knowledge to the test with the Trexperts Quiz. Take a bite out of something that didn't seem edible and join Kyle, Kevin, Amy, and Haley covering all things in New Trek, including that show that is Trek in all but name, The Orville, on Union Federation. Get your Sunday brunch ready for The View Screen, a live weekly talk show hosted by Kelvin and Amy with featured guests talking about all things Trek. pour a glass of wine and spill some tea with Christos, where he discusses current Trek news and events and explores the world of fandom via guest interviews, all with an LGBTQIA+ perspective on What's the Tea, Bev? And Patreon members get to pass around that green bottle of Aldebaran whiskey once a month on the roundtable, and they can listen to It's Green with Mark White and Amy's Math Moments.
Well, I hope you recognize some of today's guests from that little promo clip that we had there. Let's head over to the kitchen and see how Matthew's balls are coming on.
All right. So it's been about 30 minutes. So the meat mixture has sort of firmed up a little bit. And just like in the first segment where I mentioned the key technique, which is don't overmix the mixture, you don't want to overform or over-manhandle your balls, I suppose I could say. So just really quick, sort of gently get them in ball form and you're good to go. So this mixture should make about 20. So what I like to do is, this is not pretty, but it's hard to sort of know what size should it be. So just divide it in half with your hand, sort of like that. And then you know that you want to make 10 from this half and 10 from that half. So that's sort of a cheat that I do. You're going to use that?
Well,
I'm just going to eyeball it. So just kind of grab a little pinch. Quickly roll.
Okay, I'm really surprised.
And you're done.
You are so like, it's, you don't weigh out the meatballs because you love the scale.
I know.
Or you don't use a scoop.
I sure don't.
To make them uniform size.
Just grab a pinch.
Interesting.
Roll for just a couple of seconds. Again, you don't want it to be too dense, but enough that it's ball like. And you're done.
Is that?
That's fine. A little small, but you know, we all have different preferences.
Okay.
So we go like that. Now, I'm not going to sit here and make 20 balls while y'all are watching. So here is where the Crotta glaze comes in. And then I'll make the rest of the 20 off air. But then you just sort of gently paint it with this little kind of brush thingy. I don't know the formal name. Then we're going to pop it in a 375 degree oven for 20 minutes. And then we'll come back and we'll taste them and we'll see how they turn out.
All right.
Wow. Thank you, Matt. Can't wait to see that. Amy, get yourself back over while
we... All right. I'm going to wash my hands.
Well done. Public health message announcement. Well done, Amy. You get yourself back over here while we carry on with the show and introduce our next guest. We would like to welcome to the stage Matt Jennings, all the way from Cinema Z. Matt.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us and welcome to the view screen.
Thank you for having me on your view screen. It's nice to be viewed and screened.
Why don't you tell the viewers a little bit about Cinema Z? What have you guys been up to recently?
What we do at Cinema Z is we're a film discussion panel. It's me, it's Mark, and it is Davey Ryan, who does... Trexperts
quiz,
and so what we do is we discuss films, we showcase films that you probably missed out but should definitely check out, from the independent and obscure to art house and absurd. That's also our introduction to every episode. I think we've recorded a few in the last couple of weeks. We did Dead Man. We reviewed Dead Man back in January. We reviewed The Matrix, which is my favorite.
With your dad.
With
that was so
dad.
Fun.
Oh, wow.
So, and that one is out. So definitely please go ahead and take a listen to that one. But yeah, that's what we do with Cinema Z. That's what we
And the most recent one is Three Idiots, and that's with me.
Yes. And that was also very fun. And
I think that's the name of the film.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know, it was Mark, Matt, and me. That's three idiots.
Yeah, it fits. It fits.
So, Matt, with you being such an expert on all things cinematographic, what are your thoughts on Star Trek Discovery and how it fits into kind of the big production styles that you get in movies?
Well, it's very interesting because, I mean, what we saw after Star Trek Nemesis, and then we jumped to the next movie, 2002 to 2009, so like 7 years down the road, we jumped to the J.J. Abrams verse, the 2009 Star Trek movie. And I think up to date at that point, that was like the most, that was the biggest budget, the Star Trek film with the biggest budget. And so there's just a different flavor in cinematography and storytelling. And you can see that influence in Star Trek Discovery as well. And I think that, you know, that's also testament to just, I guess, Alex Kurtzman, who was also one of the producers in the Abrams films, at least maybe the first two, I think, because he hops on to helm, you know, the rebirth of Star Trek in 2017 with Discovery. And you can see just the cinematic influence with, I guess, for one, what do they call them? Like Dutch angle shots. So you Ooh. See, you know, the shot is like not quite, it's not quite on level. I know my camera is kind of like at a Dutch angle right now. I'm not quite, you know. So, you know, you've got starships, you know, coming in out of warp like this. And actually, you know, I have slides. There are slides that I have.
Slides.
So yeah, you see there's a shot of it, and they started doing it with the 2009 Star Trek movie, the first J.J. Abrams movie, where you can see the Enterprise approaching the Narada. Oh, I didn't put them in order. Those are
oh, no, first. No, no. Okay, but, my bad.
No, it's okay.
Okay, sorry.
there's a shot you can see of the Enterprise approaching the Narada, but it's upside down, approaching the Narada. I think the Narada is the ship that's level in the shot. The Enterprise is approaching upside down. And
is it that one?
It's the other one.
Okay, hold on.
That one. There it is.
Okay.
So we worked it out. Yeah, you can see the Enterprise coming in at this, you know, upside down angle, and you've got the Narada that's, I think at that point, still pretty pretty level. And then you see, at least in my opinion, you see the shots kind of duplicated in Discovery, where you've got, for one, the bridge of the Shenzhou is at the bottom, is at the bottom of the saucer section instead of being on the top. But, you know, you've got a shot of the Shenzhou, you know, coming in, and, you know, the camera pans in to the bridge. And that's another thing, too, in terms of just the aesthetic of the J.J. Abrams films, the starships, and the Discovery era ships. You know, all the view screens have windows now. And I think that's something that we just carried throughout all of the newer Star Trek shows, which, you know, it's cool. It's totally fine with me. But, you know, we see a lot of that influence. We see lens flares, obviously. Lens flares are a very big J.J. Abrams thing that, you know, it's just part of the aesthetic now. You know, we've got that shot in 2009 Star Trek with Kirk and Spock. And there's another shot here. I think this was a promo shot. This wasn't a production shot from Discovery, but, you know, you see the lens flare influence still reverberating to this new era of Star Trek. That's coming about. So, you know, I think as we talk about Discovery and how, you know, Discovery is responsible for this rebirth of Trek and all these new Star Trek shows. What was that? I wish we'd seen the positioning of the bridge on the bottom. Yeah, I think that's very interesting. Also, from a tactical advantage, to have the bridge at the bottom of the saucer section. And
yeah, wouldn't it be more protected?
It would be much more protected. But yeah, you can see the J.J. Abrams influence just kind of reverberate throughout each show, even down to, and I know this isn't necessarily the cinematography, but the makeup design for the Klingons as well. I think in Star Trek Into Darkness, the Klingons were a little closer to what we've seen in 90s Trek. But there was a proposed design. I think this was an earlier design, which you're looking at right now, is an earlier design proposed for maybe Star Trek 2009. It may have also been a proposed design for Into Darkness. But either way, you know, the Klingons were bald. Their heads were, I guess their heads were more or less shaved. And that design definitely carried over into at least the first season of Discovery. I think the Klingons got their hair back in the second season, as I guess they were no longer at war. So it's like, hey, you know, let me go to the salon, let me get my press, you know, let me get my silk press, let me get my perm, you know, I'm ready to go. Let's go back to work. So it's just, you know, we see the reverberation of the J.J. Abrams influence throughout that first season of Discovery. I think it kind of toned down, I want to say, in that third season. Like, the action influence is still there, but I think that I don't see any more Dutch angle shots in Discovery now. It's more Star Trek of, I think, what we were used to. And, you know, and that is no disrespect to, and I want to give these cinematographers their due and their credits. And I wrote down their names here, you know, with the cinematography for the 2009 J.J. Abrams film, Dan Mendel, obviously beautiful work. And my references for the Discovery, the first episode of Discovery, season one, episode one, Vulcan Hello, Guillermo Navarro, beautiful work. Again, you know, I think that this kind of helped us to just carry things on and, you know, give us an aesthetic that was stimulating to, I think, a new audience as well, because, you know, we need that new audience for Trek to keep going. You know, I think we need a little bit of the old and a little bit of the new. And, you know, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, since we're talking about, you know, evolution in regards to the evolution of, you know, the captaincy and what was the right stuff to become a captain, I think overall with Trek in this new era, you know, we had the Abrams influence in Discovery. I think we had a little bit of it in Picard as well. Obviously, Lower Decks was a whole different animal, Prodigy. I think we see more of that as well, especially in the music choice in Prodigy. There's a lot of, to me, some J.J. Abrams Trek music in that. But I think Strange New Worlds is the final step, at least right now, in that evolution, I think, of the new and a little bit of a flavor of the old in terms of storytelling. I think Strange New Worlds is more of the 90s, 60s style of storytelling of discussing, you know, the theme of the day. And just the visual aesthetic is more updated. But I know I went a little off on topic. I guess I'm just thinking about it all as a whole, but you know, really Discovery and, you know, the J.J. Abrams, the influence of that design, it reverberated, but I think we needed that extra piece to push us forward into where we are today.
You know, I had never thought about it connecting to the J.J. Abrams films, and you're exactly right. And I've always wondered, like, why is Discovery, like, so much like a movie? And it's getting those influences from the movies. Like, I get
it. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. It's, you know, and that's just, I think, just also a testament to what's happening now in regards to television shows and movie world. That line in production quality between someone being able to look at a TV show and go, oh, that's a TV episode, or someone being able to look at a movie and say, oh, this is clearly a movie budget, that line is gone. Yeah. it's absolutely gone. Yeah.
Let's bring in Matthew and Jeremiah as well while we reflect on this too. Amy, you've got a question?
Yes, I do have a question, I guess, to everyone. So Discovery is a TV show. So when I'm watching it, and I've noticed that there's a lot of times, if I'm watching during the day, especially when it's, you know, coming out in the summertime, and here in Las Vegas, we have sunshine, I don't have a theater room. And it's so dark. And I get why it is for a movie, because that is made to be seen in a dark room in a movie theater. Do you feel that it's appropriate for Discovery to be having so much darkness in the episodes? It's made for TV.
Well, I'll take this one first, Amy. I think, you know, we've got to look at it not only how it's cinematically filmed, but also how modern TVs are, which they're basically now smaller versions of a theatrical screen with the formatting and the picture technology. As far as the too much light in Las Vegas, I highly recommend room darkening blinds and heavy drapes that black out the light, which I have throughout my entire house. So there's very little natural light in here. So on a 75-inch TV, it is still very much a cinematic experience, at least from my point of view, which makes it very highly enjoyable.
Right. And it's not enjoyable when it's not dark. That's just what I'm saying.
Right. So I'm recommending, like, you know, getting, you know, light dampening drapes and room darkening.
Oh, so
blinds.
You're just saying get over it, Nelson. I hear you.
I'm just trying to help you enjoy it yeah, for the best possible.
I don't have this problem in the UK. We don't get sunshine.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a problem here. We shouldn't have to buy curtains to watch TV. And to not talk about the other universe too much, I've been binging Star Wars The Bad Batch recently, which is a cartoon. But it's third season. It's a freaking cartoon. I can't see anything. And it's a cartoon. It's so dark. And it's like, this is a pervasive problem. I think go on Twitter, anything that talks about TV shows or movies. Yeah, Picard season 3 was dark. TV is just dark because I think these producers are watching it, like screening the episodes on like the fanciest of fancy stuff, which we don't have at home. They need to watch it on home TVs, whether you have the newest thing. I just want to see what's happening on the screen.
I think that's absolutely right. I've got to say, Amy, in regards to Discovery being so dark, that first season was very dark. And I remember my little nerd heart, my frustration was that it took me a good, I don't know, maybe 5 episodes to know what the USS Discovery looked like in total.
Yes.
I was like, what does it look like? I don't understand.
That first season's also really blue in space. And it's hard to make out the Discovery with all that blue. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I did, sorry, Amy, how I bought the two TVs I've owned as an adult is the first time when I bought my plasma TV, I took my DVD player and disc one of season 4 of Voyager to the store with me and made them hook it up. And I bought the TV that Scorpion Part 2 looked the best on.
That's a good idea.
I did the same thing with my new 75-inch TV again. Bought the TV that Scorpion Part 2 looked the best on because it's very heavily 90s television CGI. So I bought the TV based on how it absolutely looked. Then when I get it home, I played with the settings and I have a custom setting for the picture quality that's called Voyager. And it is how the entire series looks the best.
Wow, that is a really good hint. A tip.
I've also noticed by applying that setting to all Trek helps kind of curb some of that darker aspect of the modern Trek.
Wow.
When other people have complained about it, I'm like, I don't have that issue. Like, I think it looks phenomenal. Then I remember, I made a custom setting specifically for Voyager, but happens to also really work well with all series.
So, Jeremiah, you might need to share those settings over on our Facebook group or on our Discord.
Yeah,
I would be interested to get those.
I will see what I can do.
I do remember at the time when Picard season 3 came out, I'm sure there was some problem where on one of the platforms it was, or in one of the regions, it was transmitted and it was super dark. It was darker than intended. And Paramount had to take down the episodes and almost repurpose them. And it was around the kind of the no-win scenario episode, like episode 4. I remember a lot of chat online. What I noticed about the kind of cinematography or the difference in the style of Discovery was that because there was no soft furnishings or soft surfaces, even the sound was very echoey. If you think of the comm chimes that you hear inside of Discovery. They're very echoey, like they bounce off all of this hard surface, which has become such a kind of a character of the series that when they carried that through into Picard for Rios's ship, that they almost had to make the joke about the carpets on the Enterprise D to kind of say, this is the old Berman era ships.
Well, it's very interesting. Again, you know, it's that, I think that just that J.J. Abrams aesthetic, and also I think just, you know, the Hollywood idea of just bigger, we have to go bigger. Mm-hmm. So I think even with the sounds that, you know, that echo trying to fill the ship, it's just, we've seen that continue. I think they dialed it back with season 3 of Picard, just thinking about the Enterprise G, formerly, you know, the Titan, which is now a smaller starship. I think the bridge is still very large, but, you know, it's a smaller starship. And, you know, in comparison to the Enterprise F that came before that, which was,
yeah,
what, two monster. Times bigger than the Enterprise E. Mm-hmm. So, it, you know, and I also think Strange New Worlds, even though it is still big, the bridge is very much, it's about the size it would have been in TOS, or as, you know, the bridge of a starship would have been in the Next Generation. So, yeah, like, I think we're slowly but surely getting back to, you know,
they always seem really cold as well, the new era ships. Amy, I think you would be freezing all the time if you were on one of those starships. You'd be reaching for your jacket.
No. Well, thankfully, Star Trek uniforms are pretty warm, as you all tell me as you're walking around STLV. It's too warm. You know, William brings up a good point. Views of the outer space on Discovery are a dream come true. Gorgeous. Like those visuals, the nebulas, and I just watched the one where they had to go into Talos IV. I'm in season 2 rewatch. And just, yeah, it was so beautiful. Like the spatial anomalies are gorgeous.
Yeah, it's, and even extend that a little bit to kind of planet scenes as well. How much, you know, did the planet Hell stage 16 get used? And we joke about it now, but in the now modern days of things like the AR walls, everything is so rich. So, I mean, Matt, what's been your perception of the use of this emerging technology in Star Trek?
You know, I think the AR wall, it's very much like our modern day, you know, digital backdrop. And I think while it's great for it to be used, I am assuming it's a money saver as well. There is still something that can't be duplicated when you don't have real effects, stuff.
Tangible.
And I mean, and look, you know, I don't work in that side of production, so, you know, I'm not gonna say, oh, you should, you know, I want to touch the leaves, I want to, you know, because, you know, only God knows what, you know, how much time you have to put stuff together, you gotta, you know. So, but I do have to say, you know, there's something about being able to really see it up close, and know that it's not a generated image, that is very special. I think those things hold the test of time, and maybe in this area of AR walls, maybe it's more just a marriage of practical and digital really working together. I think that's when effects stand the test of time. I think about, you know, First Contact, Star Trek First Contact, that shot of the Borg Queen coming down and descending into her suit, which I heard take months. I think months to finish to do. But that effect to this day, that was 96.
96.
And you know what? It's 2024. It looks amazing. It still looks good. It holds up. So
I do believe that they actually won the Academy Award for that too.
Rightfully.
I can't remember if they were just nominated or if they actually won. Either way, for Star Trek to get that kind of recognition.
you know, rightfully so. I mean, I love building model kits personally. A little thing about me, I love building model kits. I did it during the pandemic a whole lot, just to keep me sane and to pass the time. And, you know, I love the studio models that we got to see that were used, you know, during the early TNG movies and all of the TOS movies. I mean, that's also a tedious chore, you know, within itself. I think Seth MacFarlane kept it alive for a little bit when he did the first season of Orville. He used studio models for the Orville. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's something just special about knowing that models. Work, you know? Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I think, look, you know, I think just marry the two together.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you'll stand the test of time with your work.
Wonderful.
I hate to bring up Star Wars again, but I read an article about The Acolyte, which is the new show coming out.
Yeah.
And all the other shows have been using their version of the AR wall, and The Acolytes, we're not going to use that. They're going back to practical, which I think Ooh. Is really interesting, assuming yeah. I understood that article I read correctly.
Well, you know,
I wonder if Star Trek might be like, you know, maybe we do need to go back.
I think they will. I mean, you know, J.J. Abrams kind of did it as well. I mean, he did it with 2009. Like, there were, I think, some tricks that he did with the 2009 film. Can't remember specifically what they were, but to save money. But I think it was practical effects that he used. If we look at Star Wars: The Force Awakens, in comparison to Star Wars: Revenge of the Sith, you can see that there was a very big reversal and return to practical mm-hmm. effects. I mean, obviously CG as well, but there was more practical effects in Star Wars. Like, all those worlds in The Force Awakens were built and tangible, whereas in Revenge of the Sith, it was all green screen. Yeah. And so I think, you know, I guess thinking about J.J. Abrams and his influence, again, you know, it's that return to practical that really adds something special to it.
Wonderful. To completely jump genres for a second, I love the practical. I think that there's nothing more beautiful than a physical ship model myself. Yeah. But on this upcoming Beetlejuice sequel, Tim Burton has said that the effects are practical, including using stop motion animation, which we all know I'm a huge fan of, like the original Beetlejuice did. So it's practical. It's got the stop motion that the original is known for, which has just really upped my excitement about it. Is there's you just cannot beat the feel of those tangible effects.
And wonderful. What I love sometimes, go ahead. What were you?
No, go on, Matt. You finish off.
I was going to say, you know, what I love sometimes too, with certain cinematographers, film directors, if they want to have the film have like an older tone and older style, I've heard that sometimes they'll purposefully put like dots or flickers, you know, in the
little grains.
Yeah, add some grain to. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
I think it's.
Nice I've done style. That in some of my own animation. Wanted it to look grainy, like it was on 35mm film.
Yeah.
Oh.
Nice. Wow.
Well, nice. Matt, thank you for reminding us how beautiful Discovery is. But yeah, I don't know if anyone else can smell burning, so maybe we should head back over to the kitchen there. I can see some stuff's come out the oven. So Matt, Jeremiah, thank you so much. And let's check in with Matthew over in the kitchen. Amy, you better get yourself over there. So how's it looking, Matt?
It's looking good. They just came out of the oven.
Oh my gosh, you guys, it smells so good in my house. I wish we had smell-o-vision.
Yeah.
That's so good.
So now I'm going to reglaze with a separated out Prada sauce. This is not the one where the raw meat
touched.
Thing went in. So I did split it in two. I know food safety matters. Go. I don't want to give you food poisoning.
Thank you.
But I just got to do one final little baste here and then we're ready to taste.
Oh my gosh, they look so good.
Yeah. You want to grab the plates
yes.
for us, please?
So I take it. I mean, if people don't eat meat, you could substitute this out with vegetarian meatballs or falafels or something, maybe.
I would assume so. I've not really experimented a lot with the plant-based meats. I've eaten them at restaurants.
Yeah.
But in terms of me cooking with it, I don't have any experience.
I bet it would be great because those meats are, plant-based meats, they're really good to hold stuff. And I bet, tofu? Or I don't know.
I'm not sure. You know, obviously you have to find a substitute for the anchovies, which is adding umami, but there are things you can use. Or just leave it out, honestly.
Yeah.
In this case, because these are not beef, I meant to mention this earlier, because these are not beef meatballs, which would have more of a beefy flavor, I think that's the role that the anchovies are trying to
accomplish. Look at those.
There we go. And let's...
So how do you serve this up, Matthew?
I'm just going to... Well, no, you wouldn't really eat this as a... by itself.
It's like an appetizer.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
To put it on your buffet board.
Right, so maybe like with a bit of salad, any kind of dip, or is the glaze enough of a sauce?
I think the glaze is enough, and there's extra if you want to dip in there. The book says it pairs well with Klingon blood wine.
Nice.
And fried potatoes or a fried dough. So excellent. I'm not sure I would have selected.
Is there a photograph of the dish in the book?
There is.
And I'm just wondering if we can hold it up against your own. So just we can see what a great job you've done. So that's the official.
Yes. Let's
see, Amy. Don't tip them off the plate. Look at that. Well done. Well done. Now, I guess the only thing left to do now is the exciting bit, certainly for you, Amy. How did it taste?
I think definitely the not over mixing and the not compressing the balls.
Don't compress your balls, people.
Yeah. It's very light. These are way better than anything you could get. Oh my gosh. And the flavor.
What do you think of the, can you taste the anchovy? Because I cut back from what the recipe calls.
Is it fishy tasting?
Slight. I don't know that I would do much more, actually.
I don't know that in this, because again, the recipe calls for 2 ounces. Last night, I recipe tested with 1 ounce. This is about 0.6 ounces of anchovies. I don't know that I would know what's in it.
Right.
You would just know it tastes meaty.
Well, and I might, if we were to do something different, make it a little more spicy, like sriracha maybe.
I actually put more sriracha than the recipe called for. I agree. It needs more.
Yeah, a little more heat.
Yeah.
So, I'm just sat here watching you eat. So let's level the playing field a little. Let's bring Matt and Jeremiah in. And Matthew, why don't you remind the viewers of your source material? Show us the book again. Who's the author? Which is the book? Because there's a few Star Trek cookbooks around.
This is the newest published one, the Star Trek cookbook by New York Times bestselling author Chelsea Monroe Castle. So you should be able to still find this in bookstores or any online book retailer because it's the newest book that there is.
It's a really good one. I got given it for Christmas. There's lots of cocktails in there as well for those of you who just like a drink like me. Jeremiah, have you ever made anything from the Cooking with Neelix book that did the rounds a few years ago? I'm wondering if
I have not. I want to. I actually have 2 copies. I have one that is pristine that I won't bend the spine on and keep it in the Trek book archive. But I do have a not so pristine version I found secondhand that's in the kitchen specifically to use. However, I haven't had the occasion to use it because I only enjoy cooking when I'm cooking for others. I hate cooking for myself. I will spend a stupid amount of money just getting food to go. To keep myself fueled rather than go into the kitchen and cook. I loathe it unless I'm cooking for other people. So I haven't had an occasion. None of the people that you guys are, the ones that I would want to do that for, and we all live so far apart.
Yeah. It'd be cold by the time I got there.
Yeah, it would. One of the replicator to keep warm.
The Neelix book has, in my opinion, the better recipe for Hasparat. Where I do know the new book has a Hasparat recipe, but I prefer the old one. So that's my little Bajoran preference there.
You can also just take anything and make it Star Trek themed for food.
Make it blue.
Not to make right. I was experimenting with some chicken and some Italian seasoning and some other things that I found and called it Romulan Vulture. You know, because it's like got the Romulan, you know, it's part of their icon, you know, the Romulan Vulture with Romulus and Remus in it. And I was like, it looked kind of weird once it was done and it had kind of this very interesting flavor. And I'm like, let's make it a Romulan dish.
Nice. And what about yourself, Matt? Do you make any Star Trek snacks while you're watching all your films?
Oh, girl. Okay. So here's the story. So I believe it's from the Neil's Cookbook, which I do have. It was a gift from my friend Amanda. And I was trying to make, I was going to surprise my boyfriend at the time with I think it was jambalaya, because I was looking up different dishes and I was trying to find something easy to make. And I thought this will be easy and quick to make. I was so wrong. And I did not read the whole, I didn't read all the directions. And at the very end of it, it said, this is not an easy dish to make, or this is not.
It even told you.
It even told me. And I just did not read the whole thing. So that was quite an experience. I will return to that book after I've gotten over my trauma and healed from my wounds and my humiliation.
I did something very similar. There was a shrimp recipe I wanted to make, and I knew that it took 24 hours of prep time and decided do this in 2 hours. And by not following the 24 hours prep, the batter wouldn't stick to the shrimp, obviously, and it just disintegrated in the fryer. But worst part is it requires flat beer, right? I decided, I'll just throw the beer in the blender and get it to go flat by spinning it around. And this is my, you know, nice high dollar ninja with the locking lid.
Oh, no.
And it blew the lid off, destroyed the blender because it broke the locking mechanism and sprayed beer all over my kitchen.
Wow. Don't try this at home, people. Yeah.
Exactly. Follow the prep instructions. If it says 24 hours, it's going to be 24 hours.
I've got a quote from Captain Sisko as well regarding, I guess from Captain Sisko's dad, technically, regarding cooking. Worry and doubt are the greatest enemies of a great chef. The souffle will either rise or it won't. There's not a damn thing you can do about it.
I love that. And what a great impression as well of Joseph. Well done, Matt. Well, Matthew, I can, your balls are getting cold. So
getting cold. We don't like
enjoy
cold balls.
Your dinner. I bet Amy's got some wine that you can recommend to go with it.
I'm sorry, what was that last question?
I said, I bet Amy's got a fantastic wine recommendation of what she can pair with it. Amy likes her wine. But Amy, you better get yourself back over here. Okay. You've got a job to do. So guys, thank you very much for coming onto the view screen. You enjoy your dinner, Matthew, Matt, Jeremiah. We'll see you a little bit later. Right. Are you back with us, Amy? Are you all plugged in?
Here we are. Oh, well, just a special thank you to our amazing hosts who came on. Again, Matthew has the Food Replicator. So go check that out. It's on YouTube. We've got the link in the show notes. And he does put it out as a podcast. So you can either watch him on YouTube or listen to the audio. And we have Captain Jeremiah of Captain's Couch coming soon to you, some Voyager discussions, and of course, Matt with Cinema Z talking all things films. It's really interesting to, one, see what films they do choose and then to hear them talk about it. And I listened to their podcast even before watching the movie, and I'm like, that was a great discussion. And I went and watched the movie and it was wonderful to do it that way or watch the movie first and then listen to the discussion. It works both ways, surprisingly.
Wonderful. Amazing. Amazing. Well, we would love to hear what you thought of today's bonus encore episode, and we hope that you'll join our Facebook group, the BQN Collective, to continue the discussion there. Or you can head over to our Discord channel pick up on the chat over there. You can find the invite code for Discord in the show notes underneath.
Yes. And a special thanks to our Strange New Pod. What a great group they are over there for letting us to participate and open up their last days of Disco Festival. We look forward to many more future collaborations. This has been really fun.
Yeah, big thank you to Giraffe for MC and the team over at Strange New Pod for inviting us to put this special episode on for them. Yeah. But with it being our final episode, Amy, I think, is there anybody else we need to thank as well as our loyal viewers?
Yes, a huge thank you to our current Patreon members who we would like to name out individually. And that is Jason Anderson,
Jerry Antamano,
Vera Bible,
Susan Capuzzi de Clerc,
Jim Cooper,
David,
Chrissy de Clerc de Loggy,
Lars DeSenza,
Thad Haight,
Matt Harker,
Peter Hong,
Shalimar Lewis,
Jim McMahon,
Joe Migone,
Mahendran Radhakrishnan,
Tom Van Scooter,
Jonathan Snow,
Riker Tattoo,
Davey Willett,
and Carl Wonders.
And if you would like to support us or the network, please go to patreon.com/BQN. And don't forget to like us and subscribe to our YouTube channel so you won't miss our upcoming season 2 starting in September.
So September may seem a long time away, so that is the view screen done. However, as we said last week, Amy and I will be heading back over to All Good Things, which starts recording in a couple of weeks' time. And we're hoping to drop our first episode of the new season on wherever you get your podcasts around First Contact Day. So that kind of first couple of weeks of April. But in the meantime, Amy, thank you as always.
Thank you.
It's time to end transmission. Have a great day.